us, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. A new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
For over 35 years, the volunteer staff at KUCI has worked hard to bring you quality music and public affairs shows. Now is the time of year to give something back. Call 949-824-5824 during the KUCI Fund Drive from April 28th to May 8th to make a donation. Your contributions go directly to keeping KUCI on the air.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
KUCI is now podcasting its public affairs shows. The podcasts are available on www.kuci.org/podcasts. That is www.kuci.org/podcasts.
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And before we bring on our guests, first being Devyani Saltzman, the second being Wendy Johnson, I want to tell you about the fund drive that is going on here at KUCI. Every year at this time, we have a fund drive. It's the time that we raise money for KUCI to keep all of these shows, to keep my show on the air. KUCI is a nonprofit station. We broadcast from UC Irvine, and we are one of the very first radio stations to broadcast via the internet, one of the first iTunes podcast stations. My show has been podcast for a while now. And there's so much going on here, non-commercial music, public affairs shows that you just can't find anywhere else. And so we need your donations, whatever you can give. It's tax deductible. And there are premiums. There are books. There are CDs. There are DVDs. If you're in the area, there are tickets to local concert venues. There's all kinds of stuff going on, things you can choose from. If you want to see what the premiums are, go to kuci.org/fundrive/. And you can see. And if you call and make a donation at 949-824-5824, that's 949-UCI-KUCI, not only will you be doing a good deed, but you will put a smile on everybody's face here, most of all on mine. The worst thing when you are hosting a show during a fund drive is to have a silent phone in the lobby. No rings. I would love you to make the phone ring so that I can mention your name on the air. So call 949-824-5824 and help us out. Help us pay the bills, the phone bill, the electricity bill, so on and so forth. Okay, today my guests are, again, Devyani Saltzman and Wendy Johnson. First up is Devyani Saltzman. She's author of Shooting Water, a memoir of second chances, family, and filmmaking, published by Newmarket Press. Hi, Devyani.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on.
It's nice to be here.
Talk about your book, Shooting Water. Tell me how this came about.
Absolutely. It's my first book, as you said. It's a memoir set between India and Sri Lanka. And how it came about was that my mother, who is a filmmaker named Deepa Mehta, invited me to come to India to work on a film called Water, which just released in the United States on Friday, a film about Hindu widows and how religion treats them, which is not too well. And I was 19 years old. I went to work with her on this film, and about a month into shooting in Benares, the holiest city in Hinduism, the film was shut down. And I watched my mother's effigy being burned and our sets thrown into the holy river Ganges, and we had to leave the country. And only 4 years later did we get to make it in secrecy in Sri Lanka. So the five-year odyssey of bringing this film, Water, to light is the backbone of the memoir, along with my relationship with my mother.
Hmm. So the subtitle, A Memoir of Second Chances, Family, and Filmmaking. Talk about that. Talk about what happened with your mom.
The second chances applies twofold. Firstly, as I said, to the film being shut down and having to be revived in secrecy in Sri Lanka. And secondly, when I was about 11 years old, my parents divorced, and I'm an only child. I'm half Indian, half East Indian, half Jewish, and I was asked to choose who to live with, and I chose my father. And that created a rift with my mother that lasted almost 8 years. So when she invited me to come to India to work on the film, it was our second chance as a mother and daughter. So I think that's an emotional story that's universal, whether someone's interested in South Asia, politics, or film.
Mm. What sort of things did you have to pay attention to in writing a memoir, especially after the Fry debacle? Were you concerned at all that it was going to come out and people were going to go, yeah, yeah, a memoir?
The Fry, what happened with A Million Little Pieces happened after Shooting Water was put out, I believe, but obviously going into it, I worked from research. I worked from a combination of my own diaries as well as international media that covered the shutdown of Water in India. The American press, the BBC, the Canadian media all covered it. So I used those articles, diaries, and I talked to people who worked with us on the film. And emotionally, it is my story as a single daughter going through divorce, and I think you have your own perspective in memoir, and I tried to put it out in a nice way. It was never meant to be trashing parents. It was very much about finding love again with my own mother.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Devyani Saltzman, author of Shooting Water, a memoir of second chances, family, and filmmaking. I love what Publishers Weekly said about your book, a lush, evocative memoir. Saltzman never loses any of the threads she delicately weaves together, and you got a starred review.
Yes, that was quite nice.
Yeah, how thrilled were you, actually? I mean, I would be so thrilled. That what a wonderful, wonderful way to set your book into the market stream.
Absolutely, and especially I think, you know, I really support young talent in whatever medium, and as a young writer, it's just you need that kind of thing to happen, as well as word of mouth, to be able to go on and write your next work.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of writing this book, Shooting Water, you said that you drew on diaries, and I'm curious if you knew long ago that writing was going to be your thing. Yeah,
I have a good story about that, Barbara. Can I tell it?
Yeah.
I knew probably when I was about 17 years old, I always loved reading, and it was my mom who first really always dropped books off to me. And at 17, I went to work in New York for a summer from Toronto, Canada, where I'm based. And I had just read Philip Gourevitch's book on the Rwandan genocide. I'm sure you're probably aware of it. Mm-hmm. We Wish to Inform You.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really moved at his ability to talk about a very complex political situation with such a human voice, and using interviews and experiences he had. So I went to a payphone and I picked it up and I called the New Yorker and I asked for him, and they put me through, and he actually met me for an hour for a cup of coffee and talked to me about writing. And when I said, "How do you write?" he said, "With a pen." So that was my first encouragement. Yeah, it wasn't about a master's in a PhD in politics with a specialty in Africa or being a journalist. It was about being able to tell a story.
Sure. It's something that's easy to lose track of, I think, especially now when so much in publishing, we hear about marketing, we hear about platform, we hear just, until we just can't stand it anymore, how important all these other things are. And I think it's easy to forget that the writing
is discipline.
is discipline and is the most important thing. I mean, it's, if you don't have a story, it doesn't matter.
Absolutely.
What else you have going for you, it's the writing.
And when I sat down to write Shooting Water, I wrote three things at the top of my notebook: political, cinematic, personal. Two of the main motivations for the memoir was, one, when the film Water was shut down in India, as I said, the international media said controversial film shut down, a film about women who, when their husbands die, shave their head, wear only white, to atone for the death of their husbands under an aspect of Hindu religious law. But nobody asked a deeper question, why it was shut down or what the political climate was. So that was a real motivating factor for me as a freelance writer and journalist to write the memoir.
Mm.
And the other was, my mom and I live together now in Toronto, and I know Mother's Day is about to come up, and I'm 26 and she's in her 50s, and we've reconnected in a beautiful way, and I wanted to express our journey.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Devyani is going to read to us in a moment, but let me once again remind you that a fund drive is going on, our annual fundraising drive. Please call 949-824-5824 and donate some pocket change and receive a premium, wonderful premiums, books, CDs, DVDs, all kinds of stuff out there. 949-UCI-KUCI. Would you read to us?
I'd love to. I'm going to read a very short section from the book, From India, 1999. My mother and I were staying in a hotel room together because there were rumors in the city that the film was anti-Hindu, and there had been some mobs kind of gathering outside the hotel. So this is late at night, the two of us in Benares. I followed Mum into the hotel room. She switched on the bedside light and went to check the phone messages. The room was overheated, and a layer of condensation had formed on the windows, slick and damp. I sat down in a chair and started pulling off my shoes. "Quick, turn on the television." She reached for the remote, the phone still at her ear. "There's a message from our producer. We're on the news." The screen lit up, and as the static began to fade, a national news channel came into focus. The newscaster's authoritative voice announced a case of vandalism in Benares earlier today. The sets of Deepa Mehta's Water had been burned and thrown into the Ganges by angry protesters, accusing her of defiling Hinduism and polluting the holy river. Footage of our wooden sets were shown in flames on Aussie Ghat and in the laneways behind it. Mum pressed the mute button. We watched in silence as the flames licked the edges of the film set, like the pyres of a cremation ghat. Who were these people? The woman at the bottom of the hotel driveway, the man now on television, a saffron cloth tied around his head, shouting in silence as his arm punched the sky on a pixelating screen. Mum began to pull her gold earrings off. I got into the bed and lay with my face against the pillow. She put on small round reading glasses and opened a book across her knees. At moments like these, quiet and alone, I wanted to talk to her, have her understand everything I had felt since the divorce, lost, scared, unloved. But she was deep in an Agatha Christie murder mystery, and the book was as much of a wall as it was a refuge. That gives you a bit of an idea.
Thank you.
No problem.
You're a wonderful writer.
Thank you.
The book
working
is,
on it.
Yeah, the book is so pleasing that way. You know, it's you have the subject matter, you have the writing. It's great. Tell me how you hooked up with Newmarket Press.
Yes. Well, actually, when I wrote Shooting Water, I guess a little more than a year ago now, I didn't have a literary agent, and I was introduced to my Canadian publisher, Key Porter Books. And they bought the book in October of last year and acted as my international agent. So it was actually my Canadian publisher who sold it to Newmarket Press and also to Penguin. And Penguin India just published Shooting Water about 3 weeks ago.
Mm. So did you start with a proposal?
It was interesting. I kind of, the way I met the publisher is, they had approached my mom to do a novelization based on the script of Water. And I told her that I thought it would be an incredible nonfiction book. And she said, why don't you just come to the meeting and pitch it? And I came to this meeting that had nothing to do with me or a nonfiction book. And I kind of said, you know, this would be a great story. And they liked the idea. And over the next 3 months, I did three audition chapters. So no proposal, but three audition chapters. And they bought it based on that.
Interesting. Had you thought to get an agent or to have an agent look over contracts, or how did you deal with that part of it?
So when they decided they wanted the memoir, obviously I didn't feel really in a powerful enough position to negotiate my terms, and I hired a literary agent lawyer to do it as a one-off. But it was really he wasn't interested in being just my agent. He was doing it as almost like as a favor, and since then he would like to represent me. So now I'm meeting a number of people, and it's very exciting.
Interesting. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The number for donations to our fund drive is 949-824-5824. In writing a memoir, did you have concerns at all in terms of anything your mother might find questionable or anybody you were writing about? And how did you deal with that?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the main kind of emotional core of the book is the healing of a family after divorce and, you know, through the eyes of a girl who's of mixed background. But so the people I was really the most concerned about was my mother and father. But as I wrote, I found that actually they wanted to read, but they didn't want to read because they wanted to give their approval, but because they were excited for me. And I started to give them chapters every so often as I wrote, and I found that they became my first readers for creative advice. And even though I touched on some very raw stuff, they were always supportive. And I really have to, I really admire them for being that big as parents, because I am talking about all of us.
Yeah.
And but when I wrote the emotional story of reconnecting with my mom, I never wanted it to be a sentimental confessional. I never wanted a reader to feel like these hard emotions were being shoved down their throat. So I think I always tended to err on the more subtle, which I know some people want more. It's a little more gossipy, but I wanted to do it in a very clean way.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked for my family as well.
Yeah.
I think they felt respected, and they are respected, so...
Hmm. So you grew up in a creative household.
I did.
And what was that like?
I wanted to run away and be a scientist.
Of course.
My father is a documentary filmmaker and a television producer, and my mother's a film director. And I actually applied for university in England. I went to Oxford, and I applied to do genetics, anthropology, and sociology. And I was always drawn to biology because I think I wanted to break away. But I've kind of ended up back in the fold.
That's so interesting, yeah. Interesting. I know a psychiatrist whose mother wanted him to be a pianist.
Yeah.
And he rebelled and became a psychiatrist. So, yeah, there you go.
I kind of want to escape. But I think what's also cool, someone asked me this, is my mom, you know, her movie's just come out, and she's on her seventh feature, and she's well-known as a director in certain circles. And people have asked me if there was a jealousy between us. And I think the beauty is we're both working in different mediums that each of us loves. And we've become kind of our greatest allies in going out in the world with pieces of art. And it's a vulnerable position to be in, and it's so nice that we can support each other through it.
Yes, it is. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Very fortunate. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Devyani Saltzman, author of Shooting Water, a memoir of second chances, family, and filmmaking, published by Newmarket Press. The photos in the book I find to be a wonderful addition, and wonder if they were your idea or if they were the publisher's idea, how they came to be there, because you don't always find photos. You don't often find photos in memoirs.
I think that's interesting because when I read nonfiction or memoir, I tend to want to look mm-hmm. for a visual representation. I believe it was my Canadian publisher's idea way, way back, and then I worked with them and chose the photography, which is everything from a baby picture of my mom and I to mm-hmm. a news photo. I think it's Getty Images of my mother's effigy being burned. And, I think it's just important to record as well as give readers a face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. Sometimes you just want to see the faces and want to connect visually as well as through the written word.
Mm-hmm.
What about fiction? Obviously, this is a memoir. This is nonfiction. You do use fictional techniques that memoirs use, descriptive language, metaphor, simile. Do you ever feel pulled to write fiction?
I'm working on my first novel.
Are you?
Yes. It's interesting. I mean, I've always been a reader of literary nonfiction and fiction. And my Canadian editor said, you know, it wouldn't be that hard a transition for you because you naturally fall to those techniques. And so I'm trying my hand at it. But I still would love to also continue doing literary nonfiction as well.
Why is that? What is it about it that you like?
I think there are so many issues we need to discuss in this world, and I love reading fiction. But when I read fiction, I like reading something where I learn or it has a strong political edge. I just feel we have to, as people, discuss more than we do, and that's why I really respect also the film Water, because it's talking about Hindu widows and religion and women's rights, and I think it's beautiful when you can convey something important in a lovely form.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What about recreating dialogue in a memoir where, again, it's nonfiction, and yet you want to put forth what people said? How do you recreate that? Do you draw on journals and diaries? Do you imagine what was said and hope that readers understand that it's only approximate?
Yeah, predominantly whenever you can, definitely journals and diaries where you've actually recorded, hopefully accurately, what was said. And then, you know, when you don't have it written, I tried not to use dialogue when I didn't have it written in my diary. But if there was a short exchange between my mom and I had the gist of what was exchanged, but maybe not a word for word, you do approximate. But obviously not try to change their language. And I would go back to that person if I could and get them to check it. So if there was an exchange between me and my uncle, I would check it, or my mother, to make sure that I wasn't off.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the important thing, I mean, with the whole debate with Fry, is that memoir, yes, you do not lie. But memoir is also an individual's perspective.
Yes.
It's not a hard-hitting journalistic account. It's through the experience of, you know, through one's own experience. Mm-hmm. And that lens will always be different from, for example, the love interest in my book, who's a young man named Vikram who worked on the film. in the sense of every as anyone's experience will be their own take on it.
Sure. We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening who may be working on a memoir.
You know, I think the biggest thing I learned in writing was not waiting for anyone's okay. When we're not waiting for someone else's permission to create what you want to create. When I went to the meeting and with the Canadian publisher to see if I was going to if they were going to publish it, I didn't think they would. For some reason, I felt like they weren't interested, and I made a decision in the taxi over there that even if they weren't, even if I had to work at night or in the mornings, I would do it anyway for myself. And I was lucky, but I think you have to do what you believe in.
Yes, you do. I appreciate you coming on the show and putting up with my talk about the fun drive.
And I wish you all the best for the station.
Thank you. And best of luck with your book.
Thank you, Barbara.
Uh-huh. That was Devyani Saltzman, author of Shooting Water, a memoir of second chances, family, and filmmaking, published by Newmarket Press. Again, we're in the midst of a fun drive, and I would love to hear the phone ring out there, 949-UCI-KUCI. Lots of premiums to choose from, and your donation will keep the lights on and keep the phone on and keep the podcast going and on. So please give a call, and any donation counts. Stay tuned. We will be back with our next guest in just a moment. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
For over 35 years, the volunteer staff at KUCI has worked hard to bring you quality music and public affairs shows. Now is the time of year to give something back. Call 949-824-5824 during the KUCI Fund Drive from April 28th to May 8th to make a donation. Your contributions go directly to keeping KUCI on the air.
KUCI is now podcasting its public affairs shows. The podcasts are available on www.kuci.org/podcasts. That is www.kuci.org/podcasts.
Greetings, Earthlings. This is DJ ZJ, urging you to support your favorite radio station.
KUCI!
by making a contribution during the fun drive for KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
The number is 949 UCI KUCI. That's 949-824-5824.
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about the show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. In a minute, we're going to bring on Wendy Johnson. But before we do, I'd like to remind you to call 949-824-5824 and make a pledge. We're in the midst of our annual fund drive through May 8th, actually. So you can call anytime between now and then, but it would be especially wonderful and stellar and sublime if you call now while I'm on the air and make a pledge. You'll help keep my show on the air, pay the phone bills so that we can continue to have phone interviews with authors, and pay the electric bill so we can keep everything on. We're public radio, nonprofit station, and the university doesn't support us. You do. And we need your support. So please call 949-824-5824. My next guest is Wendy Johnson. She's author of another memoir called Wendy Knits, My Never-Ending Adventures in Yarn, published by Plume Penguin. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to talk with you. I am so curious about your subtitle, My Never-Ending Adventures in Yarn, and the fact that this is a memoir. And it takes place, revolves around knitting.
Yes, it does. Hence the subtitle, referring to yarn, of course.
Yes. Talk about that. How did this book come about?
Well, I have a knitting blog. I have had a knitting blog for a little over 4 years now. And it started out small. Started when blogs were young and there were just a few of us with knitting blogs, and the community kept getting larger and larger and larger. And 2 years ago, a literary agent read my knitting blog and emailed me and suggested that I write a book. And I'm always open to suggestion, particularly when it's something that I've always wanted to do anyway. So I did indeed write a book.
Interesting. So the agent found your blog.
Yes.
And brought the idea to you. That's great.
Yes, it was. Apparently it was a knitting friend of his who read my blog and pointed it out to him and said, you should look into this.
Mm-hmm. And 4 years ago, yeah, there were a handful of blogs? I mean, it was nothing like it is now. There's something like 27 million blogs.
Isn't that amazing? And there are thousands and thousands of knitting blogs.
Yes. And just a gazillion knitters that love blogs and love knitting forums and are really a tight-knit community, actually.
Yes, we are. The online knitting community really is unlike anything else I've ever experienced. There are some people from the community who I've met in real life and consider real life friends, and there are some that we call ourselves imaginary friends
mm-hmm.
that we've never met in person, but it's a very real connection. We're all buddies. Well, you know,
yeah.
Cliques form. You have little groups of friends who do things together, and you know, and it widens, and some people drop out and new people come in. So it's always changing, always dynamic, but always really interesting.
So once the agent came to you and said, why don't you do a book, how did you decide on the form that the book would take? Because it's, you know, it's a narrative, and yet you have patterns. How did it form?
From my point of view, it's like, oh good, I can do a pattern book. I can put some of my designs out there. From his point of view, it was write a process book about the process of knitting. So this was sort of, hopefully, a happy medium between the two of them. So I've been knitting forever, since I was a small child. So I have pretty much a lifetime of experience. You know, every stupid thing that I've done, everything I've figured out for myself, and what motivates me, what inspires me, what doesn't inspire me. So I tried to work that all in through the book and have a pattern at the end of each chapter that sort of illustrated what I was talking about in the chapter.
Mm-hmm. I'm a knitter, and a fairly recent one, probably the last, year and a half. And the knitting books that I like best, and I just keep buying them, are ones like yours where it's a narrative and yet there's information. And more personal than, say, a straight pattern book. And you want to know, you know, the quirks of the writer. You want to know the mistakes that the knitter / writer made. You want to be drawn into that world.
Right. It seems to be that it's sort of a new developing genre. There have been books like this in the past, process-type books, but for the past, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, the focus has been on straight pattern books or books that went into somewhat histories of different types of knitting with patterns. But it's only just recently, it seems, that the process book is becoming popular again.
Thank goodness.
Yes, I love process books in other topics, so I'm very happy about it.
I do, too. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM. We are in a fun drive, and I would love to see the light flashing to know that you're calling to make a donation to our fun drive to help keep my show on the air. 949-UCI-KUCI. Call, pledge, choose from premiums. Keep us going. It's all up to you. It really is. So the agent comes to you, suggests a knitting book. Did you then have to craft a proposal?
Yes. Well, the first thing he did was to say, write a chapter. Let me see a chapter. And he gave me a suggestion for what he thought I should write about, which happened to be something that he was interested in, hand-knitted socks.
Mm-hmm.
So the sock chapter was actually the first one I wrote, and it turned out to be a good choice because socks were something I avoided for years and years and years and then suddenly got sucked into knitting socks.
Mm-hmm.
So there was an interesting story behind it, and I also had a cute story about a friend for whom I had knit socks that I was able to slap in at the end that kind of brought it all together. So that was definitely a good choice. So I sent that off to him. He liked it. So we put together a book proposal, and I wrote a couple of more chapters and did outlines for the rest of the book, and he shopped it around for me and got me a book deal.
And you got a book deal with Plume Penguin.
Right.
A wonderful publisher.
Yes, and I love my editors there.
So how did things change once you got a book deal? You were then working with an editor and who I imagine had ideas about how it should go.
Well, surprisingly, no. I pretty much wrote the whole draft with virtually no editorial intervention and submitted it to them. And they, of course, returned it to me with their suggestions and editing, which was surprisingly very little. Of course, as soon as I submitted it, I, went through the agony of, oh, they're going to hate it. they're going to ask for their money back.
Right.
You know, they're contacting the legal department to see how quickly they can break the contract. But surprisingly, that's not what happened. They actually liked it. And very few edits. There were some excellent suggestions from my editor, some suggestions put in more explanation here, explain this, maybe you should write, you know. And also very, very good ideas about reordering a couple of the chapters that really worked much better than the way I had it.
Hmm. So you, as you said earlier, you had a blog for quite a while. In publishing, and I don't know if you got this, but platform is so often discussed in terms of if you have a nonfiction book that you are trying to sell, often agents and editors say, well, you really have to have a platform. You have to be in the public eye in some way. Now, your blog did that for you. I don't know if you realized it at the time or if anybody said to you, anybody in publishing said, the reason why we know this book will sell is because you have a website, you have a blog, you have lots of people who know about you, and that's a really great thing. Did you get any of that?
Well, I don't know that anybody said that to me, but it was obvious to me because my blog is fairly popular. I mean, judging from the emails I get from people, you know, I get anywhere from 25 to 100 emails a day from people asking for advice, just telling me they like a certain thing, you know, asking for a pattern recommendation, a yarn recommendation. So it definitely is on a lot of people's radar.
Give that address, that your blog address.
It's wendyknits.net.
How do you deal with all of those emails? How do you find time to do anything else?
It's a good thing that I'm an insomniac. I get up very early in the morning. I answer a bunch of them before I go to work. I answer a bunch of them during my lunch break. I answer a bunch of them when I get home. And just, you know, try not to let them pile up. Otherwise, I will be overwhelmed.
Hmm. You're listening to KUCI 88.9. I'm speaking with Wendy Johnson, author of Wendy Knits, My Never-Ending Adventures in Yarn. I am curious how the whole idea of memoir came into your book. I know we talked about it being a process book. It wasn't going to be a straight pattern book. But did your editor or agent really push the idea of, you know, you really need to make this a memoir and really make it personal, or what? How did that come about?
I think it was sort of by accident. That's just how it evolved. Because it's a very personal subject for me, and how I grew up with knitting, you know, the interactions with other people have all affected it very much. So it just sort of turned into a memoir, and I didn't really think about it until I saw the publisher's description of it, where they described it as a memoir, and I thought, huh, look at that. It's a memoir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how about the title? Did you give them the title? Did you work with them on coming up with the title and the subtitle?
The main title was always Wendy Knits, because we figured the brand recognition, since that's the name of my website. We had a different subtitle, but the publisher suggested changing it.
What was it?
The original subtitle was My Adventures with Two Needles and an Attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, my agent came up with that title, and he pitched it to me over the phone, and my response was, what, you think I have an attitude? Which pretty much answers that question. But when the publisher suggested changing it, and they kicked around a few ideas, and some of them I didn't like, but I liked this one. It was just kind of fun, because it is always an adventure.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's really, as I got into knitting, I became amazed at how very many knitters there were, and how there are so many male knitters, too. Yeah. Which, you know, it used to be a stereotyped activity of our grannies knitting. And over the past few years, it has so changed.
Well, you know, I was, a year or so ago, I was at the late night gathering in my local yarn shop. And there's a group, a loose-knit group that shows up pretty much all the time on late night. And there was a woman coming in with a trunk show of yarn. And she had her husband with her, and he was carrying the yarn in. As he was carrying it in, we were sitting at the back table. We were arguing about politics. We were arguing about baseball and anything else we could think of. And he was coming in and out, carrying in the yarn. And he finally said, you know, if I closed my eyes, I would think I was in a bar in Boston. And it's true. I mean, it's such an interesting group of people, such a wide variety of experience of the people who knit that, and of course we all bring our personalities to it and rather loudly at times, but it really is interesting, and I've met such a lot of interesting people through knitting.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM. We're here for a few more minutes. I'd love to hear the phone ring one more time and know that somebody is calling to pledge a donation at 949-824-5824. That's 949-UCI-KUCI. Keep us on the air and allow us to continue to do wonderful things. KUCI was one of the very first radio stations to broadcast via the internet. We now have podcasts happening. We have so much going on here at University of California Irvine campus, playing non-commercial music, non-commercial public affairs programs. So please call 949-824-5824. I am speaking with Wendy Johnson, author of Wendy Knits, My Never-Ending Adventures in Yarn, published by Plume Penguin. Do you find, Wendy, that there are too many? Do you think there are too many knitting books being put out? Or do you think that with the gazillion knitters that there are, that there can never be too many?
Well, I am a firm believer that there's no such thing as many books, period.
Mm-hmm.
And being a voracious knitter, the corollary of that is that there is no such thing as too many knitting books. I buy knitting books constantly, so I'm always happy to see new ones coming out.
I'm trying to figure it out because, as I said, I'm a fairly new knitter, and yet I buy more knitting books than I could ever possibly use. And
you never know when you're going to need one.
It's true. You never know. I just love to see them there in a pile. And I'll buy one and look through it and love it and put it down. And I'm happy that it's there. And I may not pick it up for weeks. And I think, well, you have so many. Why buy another one? And then another one comes into the house and another one.
At some point in the future, you will remember something from a book you bought years ago and think, that's exactly what I'm looking for.
Yes.
And you'll go dig it out and find it. That's happened to me time and time again. I've been collecting knitting books for 30 years. And some of the older ones are the most useful, and I keep going back to them. Oh, Stitch Dictionaries, the Elizabeth Zimmerman Knitting Almanac, the old books. But the new ones, there's some wonderful new ones, too, that I'm finding just as valuable.
Yeah, and you probably have some of the old ones that are out of print and going for hundreds on eBay at this point.
Yes, I do. And, yes, if I ever fall on hard times, I can always sell that knitting book collection.
You had mentioned socks. Are socks your favorite thing to knit?
Well, actually, at the time I wrote the chapter about socks, I had gone off knitting socks and was sick of them. And that was 2 years ago. And since that time, my agent has been harassing me to knit him socks So I finally did in March, and now, unfortunately, I am addicted to socks again.
What is it about socks?
They're so convenient for commuter knitting. I take the train to work every day, and I've got my own sock pattern, of course, and I've memorized it. And the sock is small enough that I can fit it in my purse. I'm not going to stab the person sitting next to me on the train with a long needle because I use the little short double-pointed needles. And, you know, you can pick it up or stop at any time. And I only knit socks while I'm commuting and at lunch at work, and I can generally crank out a sock in a little less than a week. So that's 52 weeks a year. That would be 26 pairs of socks in a year.
Now, what do you say to people that say, I can buy a pair of socks for $3.99 at Target, or, you know, sweater, I can buy a sweater for $19.99 at Target?
I say, honey, this is wearable art.
Yes.
You know, and people who've never worn hand-knit socks do not understand just how wonderful they are.
Mm-hmm. What do you do on your book tour? What do you do when you go into bookstores or knitting shops promoting your book?
Well, actually, I've only had one stop so far because the book just came out week before last,
mm-hmm.
or last week, I guess it was, and that was just a straight book signing. On Saturday, I'm going to the Maryland Sheep and Wool Festival, which is a very, very big deal indeed. It's a festival that's been going on every year for over 30 years. Knitters and weavers and spinners and anybody interested in sheep and wool and fiber flock to it from around the country. So I'll be there signing books for a couple of hours. And in a case like that, it's just a matter of signing and talking to people. And there's a lot of people I know I'll meet that I know online.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be great to be able to put a face with the website address.
Yeah. It's like there's this sort of almost an underground cult of knitters. Because unless you are one, you don't realize all the stuff going on and, you know, just the community that there is. It's interesting.
It is interesting, and it really is a great community. We do charity projects, and, you know, if ill fortune hits someone, their friends rally around and help them out. It really is a great community. I've seen a lot of good things come out of it.
Well, I appreciate your time and really wish you the best of luck with your book.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for coming on.
It was my pleasure.
That was Wendy Johnson, author of Wendy Knits, My Never-Ending Adventures in Yarn, published by Plume Penguin. And it's just such a fun book. I do love these knitting narratives. I'll tell you, I'm addicted. What can I say? I don't know. I don't know how it happened, but it happened. Anyway, our fun drive is still going on. It will be going on for a few more days. Please make our phones ring. 949-UCI, KUCI. Call before 6 o'clock Pacific time, 9 o'clock Eastern time, and help us stay on the air. I would so appreciate it. 949-824-5824. I am going to leave you in a moment. First, I want to say, if you want to know more about the show, go to penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower. You will be brought to the radio page. Lots of podcasts up, in part due to KUCI. Again, the number is 949-824-5824. Lots of shows. There must be, more than four dozen up now. Thanks to Rob Roy, who helps me every week put up a couple more on the podcast. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Patrick Kavanaugh, who said, actually, this is in the beginning of Shooting Water, the epigraph. He said, "Let grief be a fallen leaf at the dawning of the day." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and the fun drive is still going on. Call 949-824-5824, and Thanks so much for listening.